So, welcome to the new year. That's a nice thing, our first meeting of 2026. This is the month that we all write 2025 on our checks and then scratch it out and write 2026. Of course, we don't write checks anymore, do we? I think that's a thing of the past. So last time we met, we covered chapter one of Joshua, and we did a little bit of an introduction to the book. The author is not stated in the book. There's no biblical claim to who wrote it. So we wind up in speculation without any certainty. Maybe it was Joshua himself. The other two that come up, not quite as much as a popular speculation, is Eleazar the high priest or his son Phinehas. Likely dates of the book are around 1400 BC. If we look at David Roll, if you remember the David Roll tapes, we would actually move that back just a little bit more, like 1410 or 1420 BC. Remember, when the numbers get bigger in BC, that's further back. Joshua was about 90 at the time of taking command. We say that because toward the end of the book, in Joshua chapter 24, verse 29, we see that he died at age 110. And so when we back it up, the scholars think it probably is about 20 years time span in there. Joshua's name means Yahweh saves, or Yahweh is salvation, which lines up in terms of at the root of the name level to be equal to Jesus, Yeshua, in Hebrew. As we look at the chapter, we see that Moses, the called servant of Yahweh, has died, and Joshua, who was a servant of Moses, is now by Yahweh's appointment moving into the command role of the Israelites as they are going to be in the conquest of the promised land by God's own effort. Yahweh himself tells Joshua, "Rise, get up, lead the people across the Jordan. Go to the land I'm giving them, the land to the sons of Israel." God says, "Anywhere you step, I've given it to you, just as I told to Moses." And we see that promise to Moses in Deuteronomy. And the boundaries are restated. We gave you a handout. The boundaries are always in relatively general terms. And there's some more of that handout if we look around, I think. I bet Royce comes in here in a little bit, and we'll get him to do that. But the handout shows a pretty broad area if you look at what was described. God says to Joshua, "No one will be able to stand before you. I will not fail you. I will not forsake you. Be sure to be strong and courageous. Be careful to do all that Moses told you. Stay on course." Joshua has a testimony in how he conducts himself in front of the people of Israel. That testimony needs to show his confidence in God. It needs to be truthful, of course, but to be timid or to lack courage, to lack strength, to lack confidence in what's about to happen would be a negative testimony. In the first chapter is verse 8. Many have memorized that. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night, so you may be careful to do all that is written in it. Then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. And we mentioned and talked for a few moments about the fact that it says not to depart from your mouth. This isn't a silent reading time only for Joshua. It's a part of how he will talk, how he will lead. It's a part of what he will be putting out as a leader of the people to the people. And so it'd be part of his speech, as well as his self-talk. What we tell ourselves is very important in life. And so he's to be telling himself the truths he sees in the book of the law. Yahweh goes on to say, "Have I not commanded you?" And he repeats it, "Be strong, be courageous, don't tremble, don't be dismayed. For Yahweh, God Almighty, is with you wherever you go." And so Joshua commands the officers, pass the word, prepare provisions. In 3 days, we're going to cross the Jordan. He goes to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and one half of the tribe of Manasseh. And he goes to them because upon their request, Moses worked with them in an agreement that they were going to settle east of the Jordan, where this conquest is all west of the Jordan. But they promised when the time came for the conquest that all of their warriors, all of their men of fighting age and ability were to cross the Jordan and fight with their brothers to the very end, and they would not return home until the conquest is complete. They affirm, we're going to do what you command, just like we obeyed Moses. And if you've been reading the books leading up or even been in this class, that's not necessarily the most comforting thing you could say. They were very rebellious against Moses at times. But the point is, we're going to do it. You're the commander, and we're going to follow you in the way that we would follow Moses in his role. And if anyone rebels against that, anyone crosses your commands, that person will be put to death. Only, they appeal to him as well, only be strong and courageous. Don't lead us timidly, they tell Joshua. And then we spent some time talking about why we as followers of Christ have even greater reason for confidence than Joshua did. Joshua had God himself there telling him, it's going to work. I've given you all the land. I'm going to do it. It's my strength, my power. It's not dependent on you, so you can go boldly. I've already won the battle for you, in essence. Well, as we looked at the New Testament scriptures, and we looked at John 16 and Hebrews 13, Romans 8, Philippians 4, 1 Corinthians 15, every one of those talks about how, yes, we'll have trouble in the world. In John 16, Jesus says, but I've overcome the world. You don't have to worry about it. Yes, it's going to be difficult, but I've already won the battle. Hebrews 13 says, be content with what you have, because God himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. In Philippians 4, it says, be anxious for nothing, but pray to God, and peace beyond understanding will come to you. And 1 Corinthians 15 says, even death itself is swallowed up in victory. And so we have great confidence. We ought to be courageous and bold in our living our lives as well, and not timid and afraid. Well, that takes us to Joshua chapter 2 that we're going to start in today. And so let me first of all read verses 1 through 14, and we'll look at those a bit. Then Joshua the son of Nun sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim, saying, go, view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab, and lodged there. It was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. It came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. Now, therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will deal kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. So the men said to her, our life for yours. If you do not tell this business of ours, and it shall come about when the Lord gives us the land, that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. So Joshua sent these two spies out, and it says secretly. And that could be taken a couple of ways. One would be secretly even amongst the Gentiles, amongst the Israelites. It also would mean secretly within the land. And they went from Shittim, which is 7 miles east of the Jordan. Remember, the Jordan is on the eastern border of what would become the land of Israel. And there on the east side, that there across the Jordan from the actual land of the Canaanites, or what would become the land of Israel. And then Jericho is 7 miles west of the border. So that's about a 14-mile distance between where they were encamped at that time and Jericho itself. And he tells them to go look at the land, but focus on Jericho. Check out their features, their defenses, their obstacles that we might run across, and so on. And so they went. When they get to Jericho, they entered the house of Rahab the harlot. And so, interesting question. Why do you suppose that's where they went?
It'd be easy to hide out there.
Probably easy to hide out there. Yep. Information passed through there. I'm sure it was a situation of opportunity for them. I mean, that obviously that's a place they found when they got there that looked like an advantageous place to be, a place where they could be not recognized or not revealed to everybody. And, you know, gave them a chance to stay anonymous, hear the gossip, and so on. Now, in verse 2, the goal was to keep a low profile, right? Send them out secretly. How well did that work? Now, the king knew they were at Rahab's house about the time they got to Rahab's house. And so keeping a low profile was unsuccessful. So the king sent word, sent it directly to Rahab, so he knew right where they were. Men from Israel are here to search out the land. And just to say a couple words about what it meant to be the king of Jericho, in this part of the world, you had all kinds of kings. Some had influence over a whole region. Later on, we're going to talk about the Amorites. And, for example, Og had influence over a whole region, a whole chunk of land. A lot of kings were city kings. And so this is a city king. He's responsible for and ruling over the city of Jericho within its limitations for the most part. And so he sends word to Rahab. What does he tell Rahab to do? What did you hear me read? Bring him out. Yes. And he gives her the motivation, the reason why. And the reason is they're here to spy us out. And they are going to be dangerous to us. How does he identify them? What does he call them? Where does he say they're from? Or what group? Men of Israel. And that becomes significant as we go down through this, because we'll even see it in Rahab's words. But let's go on for a minute. We'll come back and see that in a minute. He essentially says they're here as spies. And Rahab indeed had hidden the two men. But what she said was, they came, but I don't know where they came from. In other words, I didn't know they were from Israel, Israelites, the children of Israel in that tribe. And she tells him a story. She misdirects him. At the time they were about to shut the gate, or at the time of the shutting of the gate, these men left. And I don't know where they were going. But if you go after them quickly, you can overtake them. In other words, they haven't been gone very long. They wanted to get out of town before the gate was shut so they could get away. Hot pursuit. Essentially, from the cartoon, they went that way, you know, and away they go. And she was believed. And so they did go out and follow them. And as soon as the followers get outside the gate, what do? Shut the gate. And that was a common thing in the city. It brought protection to the city. Dark, shut the gate. Then we've got our walled city, and we'll be protected by that. Was what Rahab did honest? Was it okay? Well, let me ask it differently, and then we'll draw a contrast. Was it expedient? Yes. Yeah, absolutely expedient. I want to protect these men. I've got them hidden upstairs, but I want to protect them. Let's get the attention elsewhere. And so in that sense, it was successful. Got people looking another direction. But is it okay to lie in those situations?
I think that ultimately she was looking at for her own family. She was looking at for herself and her own family.
So if we talked about motivations, there's a lot of motivation here to lie, isn't there? First of all, she's hiding the men upstairs. That's probably not going to go very well for her personally if that's discovered. How dare you hide these men and then misdirect us? And she does have a family to protect. What does she believe about these Israelite men in terms of the threat they pose to her, her family, and even to the whole city? What does she believe? She expresses it well in the verses to come. What kinds of things did she say? We are scared to death. We have no courage left. We have no hope left. And we'll talk more about that. So here she is. She's in this fearful position. And I guess I'm still going to go back to the question. We may face these kinds of questions. Is it all right to lie?
She wasn't probably a Christian yet. She knew who God was, but she wasn't necessarily a follower yet. And a lie is a lie.
So a lie is okay if you're not a follower? I think these are the kinds of things we need to come to grips with in life from time to time. One of my favorite stories about things like this, and I'm sure you probably all read it, and many of you probably already jumped to what I'm going to talk about, but it's found in the book The Hiding Place. It's the story of Corrie ten Boom, and as they're hiding Jews, and then they did some lying. Awkward situations to try to figure out how to face, but she was at her sister's house. They had men who would have been taken in the effective draft. They'd round them up, and now you're soldiers. And they were there at the house. They had a hiding place under that house. They'd moved the table back, and then there was a rug under the table and a trap door. And so the troops are coming down the street to gather up any young men they can find. And so these young men go down in there, and they put the rug back, and they put the table back, and put the tablecloth on the table, kind of helping hide everything they could. And they redirect how their tea setting was, so there's only the two little old ladies, I believe. There might have been one other person, I don't remember, in the room. Her sister's name was Nolly. And when the soldiers came in, they didn't say, are there men around or anything like that. They just said, where are your men? And Corey said, there's no men here. And they keep asking. And finally, Nolly says, they're under the table. And Corey is devastated. Her young nephews and some other young men are going to get carted off into the military because Nolly told where they were. Well, they rolled the tablecloth up, and Nolly bursts out laughing. They think they've been made fools of, so they put the tablecloth back down and depart. And to Corey, it was a lesson in you can trust God to tell the truth. Those are hard situations, aren't they? People's lives are at stake, and it's difficult to know just how you should respond, maybe, because we let expediency become pretty important to us in certain situations where the stakes seem very high. But the scriptures don't make any real exceptions, do they? Bearing false witness is very clear in the commands of Exodus chapter 20 and other places. And so I don't know whether to endorse her lie or not, but it is the story of what she did, and creates a very difficult situation. But I do think we can trust God if we trust Him to avoid sin. And there was an example of that in the book, The Hiding Place, and how God didn't give up those young men, even though Nolly told exactly where they were. And we are going to see some expression of belief, faith in a sense, certainly, from Rahab before we're done. So she had hidden the men upstairs. Where were they hidden? Well, they were in stalks of flax laid in order on the roof. And this is a part of their garment making. And they're creating of linen. They would cut about 3 foot long stems of flax. They would soak them in water and they would separate the stem pieces out after they had been well dried. And so they would put them out on the roof so they could be sun dried, and then they could be then woven into, as they were separated out into the strands, woven into linen. And so after her lie, the men chase the spies. They're headed down the road, and they're headed toward the River Jordan. That's where they were. And as soon as they left the city, of course, we mentioned already the gates were closed. Now Rahab, after she gets rid of them, she goes up to the men on the roof, and she affirms some things. She says, and in the common English translations, it's going to say Lord all the time, but I put in the name of God, Yahweh, which is the way it would have been actually used at the time. And she says, I know that Yahweh has given you the land. She is confident that it's theirs, and she doesn't say it's by your military might. She recognized that Yahweh was the one behind their coming conquest and their certain success. She says, we're in terror. We have melted before you. And then she gives the evidence of her certainty of the blessing on Israel during that conquest. What's the first example she gives?
Parting the Red Sea.
We've heard about how Yahweh parted the sea as you came out of Egypt. What else does she mention? The victory over the two Amorite kings. How they were utterly destroyed. And those Ammonite kings, I'll get it right. But the two Ammonite kings, they're the ones east of the Jordan, right? That's where the two tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh were settled. And they'd been there a little while, but not too long. The first item that she talked about was the parting of the Red Sea. How long ago had that happened?
At least 40 years ago.
And so that word is still out there. That testimony of who God is as he did that is still alive today in the area of Canaanite. Let's go read a couple passages out of Exodus. First of all, in chapter 14. Exodus 14. And I'm going to read verses 13 through 18. And this is when the sea is about to be divided. And Pharaoh's in pursuit. I mean, scary time. But Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go forth through the midst of the sea on dry land. As for me, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so they will go in after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and through all his army, throughout the chariots and his horsemen. And this is a key verse. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord, when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen. In other words, God himself says, the word's going to get back to Egypt, and they're going to know I did this. But now let's probably turn the page or whatever. Go to the next chapter. In chapter 15, There is a song that Moses leads the people in, and his sister Miriam gets involved before it's over. But basically, it's a song after the crossing to praise God about what had been done. And I'm going to read verses 8 through 19, just a section out of that song that they sang. So I'm going down through verse 19. And the blast of your nostrils, at the blast of your nostrils, the waters were piled up, the flowing waters stood up like a heap. The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be gratified against them. I will draw out my sword, my hand will destroy them. You blew with your wind, the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you among all the gods, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. In your loving kindness, you have led the people whom you've redeemed. In your strength, you have guided them to your holy habitation. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab trembling grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread upon them. By the greatness of your arm, they are motionless as stone until your people pass over, O Lord, until your people pass over whom you have purchased. You will bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord shall reign over them forever and ever. For the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea on them, but the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea. The people, in this song, it talks about the fear and trembling and the melting away of the Canaanites in specific, but of the fear that would surround this whole nation because of what God did in parting the sea and taking them through and taking out the mightiest army of the time in the Red Sea. And the testimony of Rahab here is, we still know it, we still remember it, we still recognize Yahweh's strength in doing that. And so she says in verse 11, when we heard it, all courage was gone. We were afraid of your coming, for Yahweh your God is God in heaven and on earth. What a testimony of a person who's not in the family of Abraham. Here is Rahab saying and exalting God in who he is and his strength and his power. And she names him. I mean, she says him, she calls him Yahweh by name. They know it's the God of Israel, not just some nondescript heavenly being that they might believe in. This is Rahab's expression of faith, if you will. And it leads her to action in verse 12. Because she comes to them and says, swear to me. And she doesn't just say, swear to me. Swear to me by Yahweh. Do it, confirming through your God that out of my kindness to you, you will deal kindly with my father's household. Give me a pledge of faith. Spare my father, mother, brothers, and sisters. With all that belong to them, deliver our lives from death. She looks at them and knows that they are the only connection and hope she's got to the power of Yahweh that has come to take out the inhabitants of the land that God has given to the Israelites. So how many people are they committing themselves to taking care of and sparing? Well, we don't know. We don't know who her brothers and sisters and so on were. It's a minimum of 8. Because she says brothers and sisters, plural. So there's got to be at least 2 brothers and 2 sisters. So that's 4. She would make 5. And then her father would be 6, assuming he's married. That would be 7. But then she goes on to say, and all of theirs. So if there were children or servants or whatever, she's looking for the whole household to be saved and taken care of. And in verse 13, the two men respond. What do they tell her? What did you see? Hear me read, or what have you?
Yahweh has given us the land.
Yep.
An already assumed thing that's going to happen.
Yep, they do affirm that.
And
Yes, but there is a condition, and there'll be more conditions before we're done stated, or maybe stated, restated. What's the condition? Look there in verse 13 as they start to respond. Verse 14. The men said to her, "Our life for yours if you do not tell this business of ours." In other words, don't become a, what's the term for it? All of a sudden I lost it.
Double agent.
Thank you. Don't become a double agent. Now don't be running off to the king and telling him and becoming a spy against us. If you keep it to yourself, then when we come, we indeed will spare your father's family. And so that is the plan, and that is the pledge they make. Questions or comments over those first 14 verses? Okay, well then let's pick it up in verse 15 and read through 24, which is the end of the chapter. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. And she said to them, "Go to the hill country, so that the pursuers will not happen upon you, and hide yourselves there for 3 days until the pursuers return. Then afterward you may go on your way." The men said to her, "We shall be free from this oath to you, which you have made us swear, unless, when we come into the land, you tie this cord of scarlet thread in the window through which you let us down, and gather to yourself into the house your father and your mother and your brothers and all your father's household. It shall come about that anyone who goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be free. But anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on them. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be free from the oath which you have made us swear." She said, "According to your words, so be it." And she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and came to the hill country and remained there for 3 days until the pursuers returned. Now the pursuers had sought them all along the road, but they had not found them. Then the two men returned and came down from the hill country and crossed over and came to Joshua, the son of Nun. And they related to him all that had happened to him. They said to Joshua, "Surely the Lord has given us all the land into our hands. Moreover, all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before us." And so she lets them out of a rope in the window. What made that work was where her house was located. Her house was built into or on the wall in some fashion. That gives you a little bit of an idea of the substantial nature of the walls of Jericho. I mean, this wasn't like our current new border fence, was it? You wouldn't, I'm not making fun of the border fence, but you couldn't build a house on it. This wall was substantial enough that a person could live on the wall or in the wall in some fashion like that. And so they're big walls, and she gives them instructions. Where does she tell them to go?
To the hills.
To the hills. That is the opposite direction from the Jordan. Where Jericho is, Jordan, of course, is to their east. But she says, go into the hills, which west, away from the Jordan. And she did that to say, don't go where they're out there looking for you. Don't head right back. You might bump into each other. So go to the hills, hide for 3 days, and wait for the pursuers to return. So they're going to come back to the city when they have decided that they have lost their quarry. Then you can go on your way. Now they give her some parting words about their oath. What do they tell her? There are several things here to mention. From what I read and what you see there, what did they tell her? How? What does she need to do in order to protect her father's household?
Bring them all inside her house.
Bring them in the house. And they got to put the cord down so we'll be able to recognize which house we're dealing with. So bring them in the house, have them waiting and ready. What else?
Stay quiet.
What's that?
Stay quiet.
Yeah. If you tell them, then you're not going to be spared, nor is your father's household. What else?
You got to stay in the house.
Got to stay in the house. Yeah, anybody outside the house is fair game for us. So if they get outside the house, that's their fault. We didn't push them outside the house. That's just where they will wind up deciding to go, and they will suffer the consequences. And so those are the conditions. And and she says, as you've said, so be it. That's her affirmation that she is willing to abide by that oath. So she sends them away, and they go into the hill country, and they did indeed stay the 3 days. And indeed, it's recorded here that the pursuers came back. They were done looking for them on the road, no success. And so then the two returned to Joshua in Shittim. And what did they do? Yep, Joshua, this is what happened. What were their conclusions? They drew some conclusions out of what happened while they were gone. What's their conclusion? The Lord has surely given us this land. The inhabitants, they don't have any, their fight's gone out of them. Or at least their confidence in the fight is out of them. They're scared to death. They have recognized it's Yahweh. And surely Yahweh has given this land to us. Now, where I want to go a little bit, I think that's, where I want to go for the last bit of time we have. So I want to go back and talk about verses 11 and 12 and a few other things. In 11 and 12, we saw Rahab give testimony to her understanding, truthful, correct understanding of who God was, his power, his might. And we could draw a conclusion that based on her agreement to help them, coupled with her testimony about who God was and her expression of the correct expression of his greatness and his dominion over the earth and his ability to give them the land, that this was the primary causes of her being spared. And that, and it certainly was a part of her being spared. But there's more to this than what might meet the eye. Go over to Hebrews 11:31. Now, when we get to Hebrews, one of the chapter we're looking at is this testimony of faithful witnesses that the writer of Hebrews is laying out before the people. And he starts, of course, with the men of old. Abel begins with history and Abel's faithful sacrifice, and it keeps on going down through history. And when we get down to 31, it says, by faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. And certainly her expression of faith is important. But if we can back ourselves away from the perspective of the human interactions here, there is another thing that we ought to be thinking about. And I'm going to base it on the truths of Ephesians 1, 3, and 4 in principle. So go over to Ephesians 1. Bible doesn't want me to go there. There we go. I'm going to read verses 3 and 4. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ, just as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we would be holy and blameless before him. And then it starts out, that in love really goes with chapter, with verse 5 and so on. What does this verse tell us about the timing of God's aligning people as followers of Christ? When did he do that? Before the foundations of the world, it says, he blessed us in the heavenly places in Christ, just as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world. Now, I wanted to get the timing in, but I want to focus on the in him for a minute. It's in Christ. From the beginning, Christ, Jesus, was there at creation himself. John 1, 1 through 4. Nothing was made apart from Christ. So Jesus pre-existed creation. The Son part of the Trinity was there. And if you were here when we did Genesis, you would see that all three parts of the Trinity are mentioned in the creation story. And so there is Jesus, but God is looking ahead toward the time of the fulfillment of the gospel of Christ, making the sacrifice on the cross to purchase the souls of men, and that was planned before the foundation of the world. Fair enough? Okay. So when? Before the foundation. How? Through Christ we were saved. Now I want you to go over to Matthew chapter 1, verse 5. Now, Matthew chapter 1 is the genealogical expression, information about Jesus' lineage through the patriarchal side. Not that Joseph was Jesus' physical father, but his right to the throne of David from a Jewish perspective would come through his father. Now, Jesus traces back to the throne of David through Mary as well. But Matthew is showing from a Jewish perspective, he had every right to the throne. And so he's giving parts of the lineage. He skips, it's not every generation is mentioned, but there are parts of these generational aspects of Jesus' lineage up through Joseph that are there, and we need to look at verse 5. Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse. And it's interesting to note, can you imagine from God's perspective, when these men go to Rahab, they are going to a person that God knows is going to be in the lineage of the physical incarnation of the Son aspect of the Trinity, the Son in the Trinity. And so when the incarnation comes, here is Jesus already having this lineage. And when these men are going to Rahab, they're going to a person that will be in the lineage of Christ in the time that he is born. This will be part of the ancestry linking him to David, which that was part of the prophetic part of Christ, throne of David, lineage of David, and so on. And so sometimes we see these things from the human interaction part, and it's fascinating and it's interesting. Here are these people that are scared to death because of the testimony of who Yahweh is and the work he's already done to bring the descendants of Abraham to the point of taking the land of Canaan. He has demonstrated his great power, and people are afraid. They know they can't fight against this God Yahweh successfully. And that's quite a testimony, and we ought not ignore that or set it aside. But at the same time, this is God putting his history together just as he desired and intended. And so Rahab is significant enough. She's mentioned twice in the New Testament. And when you look at it from the perspective of how God sees it and how God orders history, that's a pretty strong testimony of what he's doing to select this woman to be the one the spies go to in their first conquest in the land of Canaan, who will become a part of the lineage of Christ himself. Questions, comments, thoughts? That hour and a half lesson that I thought would take two times, we're done. Well, anyway, yes?
This rabbit trails a little bit onto what would probably be inconsequential details, but do we know how the two, did you come across anything that explained how the two spies were able to cross the Jordan? Was it before the flood season hit, and how long it was between when they talked to Rahab and when they actually attacked Jericho?
I didn't, although the attack on Jericho is going to come quickly. We already have heard Joshua tell the people, be ready in 3 days. Well, they've got a three-day wait. Did he send the spies out as he was telling them those things? I would guess he probably did. And so 3 days later, because when they get back, the next thing we see is he is gathering his people together. In terms of year and the flooding of the Jordan, no, I didn't put any effort into that. Didn't occur to me. Sorry, no. Yes.
Been the best swimmers.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's real easy once you start talking about even things like the Red Sea crossing to recognize it really doesn't matter, because if God's ready for them to cross the Jordan, they're going to be able to cross the Jordan, and they're not going to have a problem doing it. And so it's easy to just, you know, hit the miracle button every time. But a lot of times God does use the natural order of the world and events, and the way that the weather's moving and so on just lets that be how he does a lot of things. So, but I don't know. I'm not sure of the seasons that they were in here.
You would imagine that there were crossing points in the Jordan, just from the trade perspective.
Yeah, there were, although a lot of the trails go around. When you look at the trails, the trade routes, and I'm not saying I've looked at all of them, but the majority of them cross above the Sea of Galilee. You don't see a lot crossing the Jordan, but that's just a anecdotal statement from my impressions of poor memory. Well, I'm being honest. What I know of the trade route says that, but I don't pretend to know them and don't pretend to remember them all. Anything else? Well, next week we'll pick it up with Joshua chapter 3. Thank you for your attention.